On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Ideas trump money, says Joe Biden. He'd better hope so. The six-term U.S. senator from Delaware is way behind in the money side of his race for the White House and in the polls. But Biden just keeps speaking from experience about the moment this country is at and the challenges ahead. This hour on Point, we'll hear him. Presidential candidate Senator Joe Biden on ideas, money, life, and his push for the presidency. Joining me now from New York, Joe Biden, Democratic senator from Delaware, presidential candidate, author of a new memoir. He's been in the Senate coming up on 35 years. He's chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee and a key member of the Judiciary Committee, which he chaired from 87 to 95. This is his second run for the White House. First time was in 1988. He's older and wiser now, he says, having been through a lot and learned a lot over the years. He talks about that in his new memoir, Promises to Keep, on life and politics. Joe Biden, welcome to On Point.
Great to be with you, Tom. I want to make it clear, I've been there a long time, but there's still 43 or 44 guys older than me. That's important for you to know.
Okay. Putting yourself right in the middle of the field there.
Well, it's true. Unfortunately, I've been there so long, as my dad said, it's a definition of a misspent adulthood being a senator.
Right. Joe, how's the campaign going? We see these poll numbers. You've talked about ideas needing to trump money. How do you assess where things stand, where you stand?
Well, I think they stand where they always have at this stage in the primary. That is that no one's made up their mind yet. If you look at the polls of your neighboring state of New Hampshire, the University of New Hampshire points out their polling director up there that only 8% of the people of that state have made up their mind who they're for in the Democratic primary. Los Angeles Times national poll shows that. Look, folks are trying to figure out how to pay their tuition bills coming up for college for their kids, keep their job, keep their health care. They're not focused on this at all. And if you just take a look at the debates we've had, the last debate, you had only 1 million people watch it out of 300 million people. So folks aren't focused yet. And this time, 4 years ago, Howard Dean was the presumptive winner. He had $50 million in the bank. And, you saw where that ended up. So it's wide open.
Everybody has all kinds of reputations. A piece of yours in this campaign is this, that you're maybe because of your years, because you've been around the block before, you're being more forthcoming, maybe a little more fully honest about the challenges the country faces at home and in Iraq in particular than the other Democratic candidates, not to mention the Republican. Do you agree with that? Are you being more forthright, more open, more honest, and on what front in particular, if it's true?
I'm not claiming to be more honest. I'm not the guy Diogenes found with his lantern, you know. What I am saying, though, is I made a decision when I ran this time that, and I had no intention of running again. I haven't done a political event, a Democratic dinner out of my state since in 20 years. But when I decided to run, I decided if I'm going to win or lose, I'm going to do it on my own terms. And I've been criticizing this administration for not leveling with the American people for the last 7 years. And now the Democratic critics of this administration seem to be telling the folks only what they want to hear. And both those prescriptions are dangerous. We got to level with the American people. We got to trust them. They are ready to do whatever needs to be done domestically in foreign policy. But you got to level with them. You got to tell them the truth about what we face. They'll step up.
Let's go straight to it. On the war, what do we need to know? On the economy, what do we need to know? China saying, you know, just in the last couple of days, hey, we own all your debt, don't mess with us. On the war, all kinds of solutions, but none that really look like solutions. So what's the hard truth you want to tell, we need to hear?
Well, I think the hard truth about the war is that we're in what everybody knows, difficulty, and there is no way to end it quickly. If we ended the war tomorrow, were I president and said, let's start to draw every troop out of Iraq tomorrow, it would take 10 months to a year to do it, unless you left everything behind. If you left all the equipment behind, it'd end up being used against us, just like the guns and AK-47s we can't account for. The truth is that we have candidates in my party saying that they'd get out and not leave any resistance. residual force behind. Well, what are they going to do with the 4,000 civilians sitting in the green zone there? They're going to let them die? And they say, oh, no, well, we'll protect them. Well, it will take 10,000 troops to do that. The truth is that we should level with families like mine who have a kid in the military. My son's not there now. Mm. But, you know, you can't mislead them. You can't continue to do what this administration has done. The truth is about the war, there's never, ever, ever been a war of self-sustaining sectarian violence like we have in Iraq that has ever ended well unless you've separated the parties. That's the truth. The truth is that there is no possibility of having a strong central unity government in Baghdad that is trusted by the Sunnis, the Shia, and the Kurds. That's the truth. And the truth is that we have to make Iraq the world's problem by getting the international community not to send troops, but to insist on a political solution that divides this country inside a defined boundary into regions, just like we did in Bosnia. We've had 20,000 Western troops in Bosnia for 10 years. Not one has been killed, thank God. The genocide has stopped. How did we do it?
So you want to split it up?
We divided the parties.
Sunni, Shiite, Kurd, and then... good luck. Do you really believe that nobody's going to die in the aftermath of that? I mean, we're coming up on the...
No, I'm not saying mm-hmm. that. The point I'm making is there is no possibility of doing it through a central government. And so what you got to do is what their constitution calls for. Tom, the first paragraph... Maybe I'm one of the few guys that read their constitution, 80% of them voted for. It says, paragraph 1, article 1, we are a decentralized federal system. And that means that you should allow under and Articles 1, 15, 16, 17, sorry to sound like a wonk here, but what it says is if any of the 18 governates, that's the political subdivisions, wants to become a region, they just have to vote on it in their constitution. Their constitution provides for this.
Let me ask you a historical question. You know a little bit about history. We're coming up on we're about 60 years since India was partitioned, and you know what happened after that. The line was drawn. The British were there. Maybe they played the American role. And so, you know, the line was drawn. Here's India. Here's Pakistan.
Right.
Millions displaced, maybe
exactly
a million
right.
killed. Why wouldn't that be the same scenario
because
in
we're
partitioned
not
Iraq?
We are not partitioning Iraq. We're setting up a federation. We are allowing exactly what we did in Bosnia. What did we do? We took one country, defined the border, let the militias the militia of the Serbs and the Croats and the Bosniaks become their local police forces in their regions within a centralized country, borders defined, giving them the same kind of power. You know the analogy would be, Tom? Mm. Imagine if after Cornwallis surrendered to Washington at Yorktown, okay. if we had tried to vote on a constitution, we would have never had one. What did we do? We had a loosely federated system, a confederation of states. That's what we have to do in Iraq.
Why won't that confederation just tear itself up over enmities, over moving populations, over oil and pipelines and all the rest? Why won't it just implode?
Because once you realize there's a political solution, exactly what happened in Bosnia. The people in Sarajevo, you live next door to a Serb and you were a Croat, once there was an overall political settlement, you felt no need to wipe out the guy next door to you. It eliminated that.
Because he's gone, because he's ethnically cleansed, he's moved to the next state over?
No, not because of that. By the way, the ethnic cleansing's already occurred. 4 million. Out of 27 million people in Iraq have either internally been displaced or fled the country. And so the only way to keep this together is to allow them to have control over their local police forces, allow them to have control over their local laws relating to marriage, divorce, just like our states do, only with more autonomy.
Joe, let me ask you then, you say the president hasn't leveled with the American people on this, but let me ask you, have your fellow Democratic candidates for president leveled with the American people by your lights?
No, they have not. I mean, for example, you have one candidate saying he'll draw everyone out. And you say to him, okay, how are you going to do that? Well, what are you going to do with those 4,000 people inside the green zone?
Bill Richardson
our State
saying,
Department
let's
people?
Go. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, what's he say? Well, what's the answer to that? He said, well, I'd protect them. And I said, well, Governor, do you know how many people will take to protect them? Our military says a minimum of 5,000 to 10,000 Marines. You're going to leave that many behind. You have others saying that what I'm going to do is going to end this war tomorrow. Okay, are you going to pull every single troop out of Iraq? What are you going to leave behind? Look, I don't want my son, who's in the National Guard and a captain who is, whose unit's been notified they should be ready to go in 08. I don't want him going to Iraq, but I sure don't want my grandson having to go back. And how we leave Iraq, what we leave behind, will determine whether or not we have to send our children back. Look, folks, if in fact we have let this civil war metastasize into the region, you got yourself a regional war. We leave without having a political solution, and we may have to, by the way. This may be so screwed up, we have no choice but to get out. But we have one last shot here to get a political solution. Tom, not one person you've ever interviewed, I suspect, has said there's a military solution to Iraq. They all say a political solution.
Not lately.
What is their political solution? I'm the only one in either political party, along with Les Gelb, my co-sponsor of this, who is a foreign policy specialist, the only one to offer a concrete political solution. Any president has to be able to answer the critical two-word question. After you recommend what to do, leave, stay, put more troops in, draw troops down, you have to answer the next two-word question. Then what?
Barack Obama looks at you and others who were in the Senate who voted to go in, to give the permission that led us into Iraq, and says, you know, this was the biggest foreign policy disaster in our generation. Why should we trust these guys? Why should we trust you, in effect, Joe Biden?
Well, you should trust me because I've turned out to be right about everything I said before and after. Everybody forgets what the context was of that vote. The context of that vote, which took place in September, 5 months before we went to war, was whether or not we were going to unite behind the President of the United States to give him the authority to force the United Nations to get the UN inspectors back in to prevent war. The debate was, on your program and every other, was do we lift the embargo against Saddam Hussein, which many in the world were saying was causing children to die and hospitals to close, etc., or do we screw down those sanctions?
We're talking this hour with U.S. Senator Joe Biden, Democratic candidate for president. He's out with a new memoir. It's called Promises to Keep on Life and Politics. And there's a lot of life and politics lived between the covers of that book and in the real world in Washington and beyond. He joins us from New York. Senator Biden, there are a lot of issues to touch on here, but I do want to have your personal story in the background because I think it informs all of this. And there's a couple of giant points I wish you'd just help us understand the before and after of Joe Biden on. Your first run for the Senate when you were just 29 years old. What drove you there? And then, of course, in the tragic aftermath of that, the car crash and death of your wife and daughter. I'd like to understand the before and after of Joe Biden around that. And the second, your run for the presidency in 87 for the 88 race, the before and after of that. Who went into each of those and who came out the other side?
Well, the guy that went into the Senate race as a 29-year-old kid was an idealistic young kid who wanted to end the war in Vietnam, who came out of the civil rights movement. That was the sort of defining feature of my experience. I didn't plan on running. I joined a group of reformers in my state. Most people think my state is an eastern state, like the Connecticut Peninsula or something. We're the Delmarva, Delaware, Maryland, Virginia. Two-thirds of my state geographically views itself a Southern. People talk an accent like this. It's a little different. And the Democratic Party in my state had always been a conservative Southern Democratic Party. Not always. Was when I came back from law school in 68. Dr. King had been killed. My city was one of the cities that got burned to the ground. We had the National Guard occupying it for the better part of a year. So I got involved because of that. Next thing I know, they couldn't get anybody to run. And a group of senior members did not thinking I could win, but former governors or Supreme Court justice said you should run. So I ran thinking that I could make the case, and I won by a very small majority. So I came out of that feeling like I was on top of the world,
a triumph.
That was November the 7th. I became legally eligible on November the 20th. I turned 30, making me constitutional eligible. December 18th, a tractor-trailer driver struck my wife and three children, killed my wife and daughter, and badly injured my two sons. And I, quite frankly, Tom, I wasn't as mature as I hoped I would have been looking back on it. I was angry. I was frustrated. I didn't want to go to the Senate, and thank God for a guy named Mike Mansfield and a guy named Hubert Humphrey and a guy named Ted Kennedy and others who rallied around me and convinced me. They said, look, come and stay just 6 months, help us organize. I was naive as the devil. I thought they really needed me. I said, okay, 6 months before my governor appoints anybody else. I started commuting, and my family stepped in to help me, and it took me, I'm still commuting every day. I don't live in Washington, never have. What happened was I came out of that after my anger subsided, and I realized this, I wasn't the only one this ever happened to, and I started thinking about, for real, how many thousands of people have terrible things happen to them like happened to me, and they don't have the family I had. And being a single parent, it made me realize how difficult it is for people who are raising kids, being held to the same standard every other parent's kids are. It gave me a very new and awful, lousy perspective on life. But
one that you're not alone with. How do you think that informs your view of life today, all these years later? I mean, that's the kind of hit no one ever wants to take, the kind of tragedy no one ever wants to go through, but it does happen.
Well, it does happen, and it never goes away. I mean, you know, the truth of the matter is it's like a backache. I mean, you may be able to walk, but the pain's always there. You remember it. But, you know, the truth of the matter is my dad had an expression that he always used. He'd say, no matter what happened, he'd say, get back up, champ. Whoever said anybody owes you a life, get up. And so many Americans get up every day. It's given me faith, no kidding. It's given me overwhelming faith in the resolve and grit of the American people, because look at the people look out your window. You're going to see people walking down that street face the things I faced without any help. You know, imagine what it's like for a woman on the minimum wage raising two kids after having lost her spouse. That's tough, man. That's tough. I had, as I said, my family. I have an incredible family.
You're back in a long-term marriage now, wife, Jill.
Yeah, I've been married, happily married for 30 years. God, you know, no man deserves one great love, let alone two. And I've been truly, I mean, that sounds corny, but I've been really, really, really lucky. But it taught me a lot about myself. And it taught me that I can get back up, like this country's always gotten back.
You were only 44 when you ran for president, coming up from the 88 election. What made you think you had the stuff to do it? Maybe it'll help us think about Obama.
Well, the truth of the matter is, I write about this for the first time. Mm-hmm. The truth of the matter is, I did this for the wrong reason. A lot of people were telling me that I should run, and I didn't want to run for president, but I thought what I could do is go out there and I could make a good case. I wouldn't win, but I would increase my influence in the United States Senate, and what the heck happened is it kind of caught fire, and all of a sudden I was in the middle of it. I point out in the book that 3 weeks before I was announced, I sat with my wife and said, I don't want to do this, and her comment, she didn't want me to do it. But she said, look, you've too many people put their lives on hold for you. You have to do it. And I did it not for the wrong reasons, but the focus wasn't correct. I looked at it as I was, quote, better qualified and I could win than the others running. Not I want to be president of the United States because I know what I want to do to change the country and change the world. And so I came out of that, chastened, realizing that my arrogance is a real, real tough deal. I mean, I was accused of being a lying, cheating, plagiarizing, so-and-so. It was probably the most devastating thing that ever happened to me in my life. My credibility put in question, but it was, again, I could hear my father's words. I could get up, and you know what happens is that, I learned that the American people are pretty darn fair. They put things in perspective, but I also learned my dad's expression again, which is I later learned as a British politician, which was you never complain and never explain. You just deal with it.
Get up and go. Now here we are 20 years later, and you're not running as the young Turk, but more
That's
as a
true.
Kind of a super experienced sage, the straight shooter. John McCain's doing the same thing. His candidacy's not going so great. Your poll numbers, latest I've seen, 4% or a couple of percent in New Hampshire, Washington Post. Do Americans have a problem with experienced politicians?
Well, I don't believe so. I think what Americans have a problem with is focus on this race at this point. Nobody is focused. I mean, look, at this stage, 4 years ago, Howard Dean was raging in the polls. He had $50 million. He was the presumptive winner. The guy who eventually won the nomination was neither number four or five or six in New Hampshire and in Iowa in November of that year.
Yeah, we understand that. Politicians tell us that, and we know there's a lot of truth. But still, Hillary Clinton at 48%, Obama 26%.
Yeah, but Hillary Clinton at a 49% unfavorable rating, 52% of the people in America say they'd never vote for her.
Still, on the face of it, you got a lot of the base, a lot of people who will come out in primaries paying attention now. Why do you think they're going? I mean, Hillary is a relative newcomer. Obama's is about as fresh, wet behind the ears as a U.S. senator can get. Why them out front now?
Well, because I think it's exciting. Look, if you look at it, if you told me when I was a young organizer and a young activist in the Democratic Party in my 20s after law school, that someday there would be a leading African American, a leading woman contending for the presidential nomination, my instincts as a Democrat would be, great, that's wonderful. It's exciting. It is about what our party's all about. But nobody's really begun to really bore down and focus at this point. And you know as well as I do, money begets publicity. Publicity gets name recognition. Name recognition, the early stages, gets support.
But money comes from magnetism and
No. Hey, well, let's get something straight here. Money comes from influence. Money comes from influence. Give me a break on the magnetism.
Magnetism draws it. Look at Barack Obama. What's his influence?
Yeah.
He's a freshman senator.
Yeah, but look at all the money Barack Obama has raised, and look at where he's raised it from. Look at the interest groups that are involved. There's a report out up in your paper today that something like two-thirds of his money came from PAC organizations when he was running as a state senator, a senator, and so.
As if you haven't taken money from PACs, Joseph.
No, well, by the way, I haven't. As a senator, I didn't take money from PACs. Well, I'm taking money from PACs now if they offer me the money, but that's not the generic point I'm making. The generic point I'm making here is you're talking about magnetism.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the idea of magnetism being the thing that draws all the money, I think if you take a look at the hard numbers, it's related to a whole range of things. I'm not saying that they're doing anything wrong, but I'm suggesting to you that the idea that you need $100 million to compete in the primaries is obscene. The first major bill I ever introduced as a United States Senator with a guy named Dick Clark was public financing of elections. I mean, all this stuff about how everybody's trying to prove that they're cleaner than anybody else, the truth of the matter is, it's awful hard to raise $59 million without people with significant influence contributing to you. So,
Senator Biden, we've got a lot of people who want to speak with you. Let me turn to the phones, if I may. Senator Joe Biden is with us. Dave is calling from Buffalo, New York. Dave, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you.
Sure.
Mr. Biden, my pleasure to speak with you. Pardon me for being a little nervous. I think that Yugoslavia, as you said earlier in the program, would have been a primary historical example when Tito fell as to what was going to happen in Iraq. And I think a lot of people, don't seem to perceive the similarities. 2 years ago or so, you actually suggested the partitioning of Iraq. And there's resistance to that idea, and can you help us understand where that resistance, or from whom that resistance is coming?
Senator Biden?
Sure. I think it's come from two places. One is idealists who would like to see, and I respect the view, a united democratic Iraq would be the first domino to fall in the region and make the whole region democratic, etc. Number one. Secondly, it's coming from our Sunni Arab friends, particularly oil states, who do not want to see, which has already occurred, a Shia ascendancy in the region. And they're very worried that an idea of a Shia republic within the country of Iraq would be dangerous. But well, here's what's happening. If you notice, and I say this to you, Tom, the vast majority of the foreign policy establishment is coming around to my position. Everyone from Henry Kissinger to Madeleine Albright. We're having more senators in both parties sign on to this as a default position at a minimum. And here's why. I talked to the Turks. The Turks didn't like the idea at first because they worried about a strong Kurdistan. Now they've figured it out. If, in fact, this country splinters apart, which it's likely to do, what's going to happen is they're going to have to go to war with the Kurds. That will bring in the Iranians. So they much prefer now to have a strong republic within a unified country that is not an independent nation. The same with Iran. The last thing they want, and by the way, if and when Iraq splinters, it will splinter. It will not break in three neat little parts. It will break along tribal lines. You will see four or five Sunni tribal competition and militias going after each other. I predict you'll see Barzani and Talabani up in the area that is now called Kurdistan.
Kurd civil war.
Well, absolutely, right. By the way. Yeah, by the way, mark my words.
Wow.
That's what will happen. That's what will happen.
If that's the answer, heaven help us, but maybe it is. Dave, thanks for your call. Let's go to Steve in Waverly, Iowa. Steve, you're on the air with Joe Biden.
Thank you, Tom. I am really impressed. I am an evangelical in Iowa, and I think that there are many of us here. First of all, I agree with the senator that we're just now starting to take notice and really get involved in what's going on in the caucus. But I'm really impressed. There are many things that keep evangelicals out of the Democratic Party, but I think Bob Casey understood in Pennsylvania that that's an untapped resource. What would the senator say to evangelicals that are concerned about abortion and other issues, but interested in the Democrats for the environment? What would you say to us that we might want to come and really be involved and maybe even go to a caucus for Joe Biden?
Steve, define your terms just a little. You're anti-abortion. What else do you think you need to hear Joe Biden? What other issue as an evangelical Democrat?
Well, I am pro-life, but it seems like every single other issue the Democratic Party draws me, and particularly Joe Biden. And I'm really impressed with his partitioning idea that he was right about 2 or 3 years ago. But they're telling us not to, to vote Democrat because taxpayers and third term or third trimester abortion and all these things, that'll get real radical.
Yeah,
I wanted to know his thoughts on that.
Steve, thanks very much. Senator Biden.
Well, first of all, I'd say one of the things that's happened in the Democratic Party, I've never talked about it publicly. I write a little bit about it in the book. I'm a practicing Catholic. My faith matters to me. And one of the things that's happened in the Democratic Party, we used to be the party of middle-class people and ethnic constituencies, and we seem to grow exceedingly uncomfortable, the elite in my party, with being comfortable with the notion of faith. I mean, you know, the founders did not want religion in our politics, but they did not want faith out of the public square. I mean, there's a great book I recommend to all of you that has been written by an editor of Newsweek, and it's called The American Gospel, and it's the best exposition of religion in America that I have ever read. And so we have communicated that we're uncomfortable with the idea of faith. We are a spiritual nation.
But how does a pro-life evangelical in Iowa then sit with a potential Democratic president who's on the other side of that line?
Well, I think you sit with them by looking beyond what it is about life. It's much beyond whether or not we share the same view on abortion. It's about dealing with those things which promote life, those things which extend life, those things which make life better. I mean, you know, if you're going to think about it in biblical terms, it was the people, one of the things that the Lord talked about, Jesus talked about, if you're an evangelical Christian, is the idea of tolerance. He didn't sit down and have dinner with the Pharisees. He sat down with Mary Magdalene. You know, and I think if evangelicals can look beyond a single issue of whether or not there's an exact position on abortion, to look at whether or not there is the treatment of human life before, during, and after conception, I think they'll have a better sense of meeting what I believe, presumptuous of me to say, what I believe they believe their charge is as Christians.
Joe Biden, you mentioned Mike Mansfield earlier. I got to know him pretty well when he was ambassador to Japan. Spent many very pleasant evenings with him there.
Great guy.
In Tokyo. Great guy. And from an era when Congress has always had its patchy parts of reputation, but was certainly in higher regard than now. You've been in Congress for a long, long time. It's seldom been lower in public esteem, in the polls. Why is that? And do you have something to answer for there?
Well, I don't I hope I don't have something to answer for it, because I have been a bit of a contrarian that I've been there. Look, one of the things, Mike Mansfield told me a story one day. After I came down for those, quote, 6 months to begin with, God love him, he'd have me report to his office once a week, and he gave me some assignment. And looking back on it, he was just taking my pulse to see if I was all right. And one day I walked in, and there was a senator who was railing against the Americans with Disabilities Act. And I walked in, I said, God, and he said, how's it going? I said, I can't believe so-and-so doesn't care about it. He said, Joe, what would you tell? I'll tell you who was. It was Jesse Helms. He said, "What would you say if I told you that Dot Helms, Mrs. Helms, and Jesse Helms, just before Christmas, 5 or 6 years ago, adopted a 15-year-old boy who was bound to a wheelchair?" I'd say, "God, I'd feel awful." He said, "That's exactly what they did." He said, "I want to tell you something." He said, "Everyone sent here is sent here because the public in their state found something good about him. Your job is to look at what the good part is." He said, and the second point he made, he said, "Don't question motives. Question judgment, but never question motives. All we do today is we question motives. If I disagree with someone, it's because I'm immoral
or I'm
bad."
Who's the we, the public or politicians of each other?
Well, the politicians are the ones that started it. And what happens is, it matters what your leaders say and do. When you have, in fact, a senator, as occurred before, referring to a president of the United States years ago as Bubba or Bill on the floor of the United States Senate, you wonder why kids are disrespectful. I mean, look, it matters.
You think Americans don't respect Congress because politicians don't respect one another? Is it really that simple?
No, I think they don't respect Congress for a bunch of reasons now. The one reason is because they look at us and they see us bickering. The last thing they want us to get together. They don't want us to bicker. They're sick of partisan extremes, number one. Number two, they are sick of the state of affairs. And the Democrats, I think, overpromised in the sense that we don't have control of the Congress. We barely control it. We have 50 votes. One of our colleagues is still hospitalized. He's home now, but he's not been able to vote. And so we raised expectations about what we're going to be able to do. We can stop bad things, but you can't start much when you don't have effective control. And the third thing is, we're not leveling with the American people. You're not leveling with them and telling them what the facts are. And I think they understand that. And I think it's a lack of respect and a lack of concern, and also an overwhelming understanding that this is a time of great decision for us. What happens in the next year, in the next presidential election, is going to determine the fate of this country for the better part of a generation, and they know it. There's a lot of anxiety.
Senator Biden, do you think, I know some, we hear from people who do and who don't, but do you think that the country is in the midst of a constitutional crisis right now over executive authority, presidential power, or not? And if it is, should the Democrats be throwing themselves across the tracks no matter what to try and fix it, stop it?
Well, I think we are in the midst of a president who has stretched the limits of the executive beyond its reasonable shape, but we're able to stop those excesses. The question really, the veiled question is, should we impeach these guys? And the truth of the matter is, I think what we should be doing is gathering up all the evidence to determine whether or not, all the records, determine whether or not these assertions of having broken the Constitution, broken the law, are true or not. And there's plenty of time to react to that, not only while, but after people leave office.
Do you mean impeachment hearings? Is that what you're calling for?
No. What I'm talking about is gathering up all the records. For example, finding out whether or not we have eavesdropped illegally on Americans. What the record is, finding out whether or not there were contracts that were, in fact, let in illegally or wrongly or with collusion in the war. Finding out whether or not there was direct lies and misrepresentation about the state of affairs when we were told certain things about our foreign policy.
Let's just take surveillance, Senator. What about that? Democrats have just stepped up to, give the administration what some are calling a blank check on that.
And they're
front.
Absolutely wrong. I have been vocal in my opposition to it. I voted against it. I made a major speech about a year ago pointing out that this is an absolute excessive expansion of power. I'm one of the four guys who wrote the so-called FISA law, the Foreign Intelligence Intelligence Surveillance Act back in another time of crisis. And they have bent it out of shape. And what's happened is, I don't blame Democrats for being angry, for those Democrats who stepped across the line and refused to step up for fear of being exposed to a political argument by this administration if, God forbid, there's another attack. It's a bogus argument that if there was another attack, it would be because we didn't vote to extend this power and expand the power we gave the president. It was wrong what we did. Wrong.
Let me take a call from Pawleys Island, South Carolina. Langston, you're on the air with Joe Biden.
Hello, gentlemen. It's a pleasure to be with you today.
Good to have you.
I'm one of Senator Biden's many supporters here in South Carolina. He has a long record with us. He sat with the Democratic Senator Hollings in the Senate and spoke at the funeral of Republican Senator Thurmond. I don't know. I just am so impressed with a man who has the mind of a policy wonk and the demeanor and candor and good humor of a regular guy.
Why is he at 2% in the polls, Langston?
Well, that's exactly it. I just wanted to share with you that a matter of months before a gubernatorial election here in the 80s, I went around with a button that said, I'm part of Dick Riley's 8%. He was at 8% in the polls. Mm-hmm. He served two terms as governor and two terms as Secretary of Education. So you go, Joe. It's a long time until election day.
There's a you go from Pawleys Island. Langston, thank you. Let's go to Watertown, Massachusetts. And Bruce. Bruce, you're on the air.
Yeah, hello, Mr. Biden, Senator Biden.
How are you?
I want you to know I admire you very much. I'm a student of political science. I got a degree in it, a bachelor's. I've studied it for years, studied you for years. I guess a couple of things. I'd like to see your percentage go up for you to get some staff. Somehow get that magnetism and that personality that you have out, because you do have a good personality. You're a nice guy from Delaware, a good man. Very courageous man. I'd like to see you win the Democratic nomination. I think if you have the help, you can do it.
But, Bruce, Joe Biden's not a secret. He's been around a long time. Why doesn't the flag go higher up the poll already?
I think maybe he's just kind of a quiet, nice guy behind the scenes in his personal life.
Quiet? He's a famous talker. He can talk your ear off. He's not quiet.
I know, but there's a little bit of a laid-backness to Senator Biden.
Hey.
Or something. I don't know, he doesn't, maybe Hillary blows her horn well, or she was the wife of the president, and Barack Obama is kind of a new face.
I don't know,
but here's a couple suggestions.
Okay.
If Senator Biden could, in the Senate, stop Bush from these warrantless searches, make some type of speech. I don't understand how the Congress just backed Bush on these warrantless searches.
He's already been speaking, and what's your other, Bruce?
Trying to think. Also, I don't understand how Bush gets the budget for the war over and over again. Congress has the power to stop Bush from getting that money. I think in September, they need to shut this guy down.
Joe Biden says he won't do that because of the troops. Senator, please stand by. Let me get one more call, and we'll come to you. Jill from Needham, Massachusetts. Jill, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Senator Biden. I'm so thrilled to be talking with you. I just want to agree with Senator Biden that the people haven't had time yet to really focus on the candidates. There's so many people, and I think they're waiting for a few of them to fall out. I actually took the time to listen to the last debate, and I was just amazed by the wealth of good Democratic candidates we have this year. But I think the media, with only focusing on Senator Clinton and Senator Obama, have really tended to marginalize the rest so that people aren't really listening to them. When I was listening to Senator Biden, I was so impressed.
Why?
His candor. He's willing to speak thoughtfully. He's reasonable. His intelligence just blows me away. That's the Jesuit background. I can see it all over. Between the amazing depth and breadth of his experience, but also every time he says something, he's clearly given it a lot of thought, not just on the war, on every issue that comes up. And I really, really hope that he'll be given enough exposure so that people will start to pay attention. I thank you for running, Senator Biden.
Well, thank you. Very kind.
I'm just really, really impressed. I hadn't made up my mind. I may not yet have, But I am certainly listening to you now, and I hope others will too.
Jill, loud and clear, Joe Biden, you're getting lots of thumbs up there. So,
hey, Tom, let's get something straight. No one knows who I am. Let's look at the polls. The fact of the matter is 20% of the people in the United States of America know who I am. One of the big mistakes senators make and press guys make,
yeah.
The good news is you guys have never been right, not once in the last... No, you haven't. Not you personally, but you've never been right about it.
You're talking about the polls because, predicting the outcome of,
well,
of a race for the White House.
Look. Literally, think about it. The talking heads have never been right about who is likely to be the nominee. Now, here it I just said never. But the other side of it is, guys
There's
like
a lot
me
of talking
have to,
heads out there.
We'll have
to go to the record on that another time.
Well,
okay.
Check the record,
okay.
Number one. Number two. One of the things that senators have to figure out is, hell, we are not known by anybody. 20% of the people know who Joe Biden is. 50% can recognize the name. 20% of them know enough about me to know whether they like me or don't like me.
Let me ask you about the people that...
So it's kind of egotistical of me to think that folks know who
I am.
Maybe.
Let me ask you about those that they know better. You ran when you were younger. You now say you were too young.
Yeah.
Is Barack Obama too young, too inexperienced?
No, I'm not saying I wasn't too young.
I'm saying I ran immature.
I was too immature, yes. Look, that's for the public to decide whether or not Barack Obama is ready at this point. I can tell you only one thing for certain, and the public is going to focus on it before they vote. In this election, when power is handed from President Bush to the next president, this incoming president will have virtually no margin for error. Hear me? No margin for error. That has not occurred since 1932. Period.
On the economy, on security.
On the security, on our place in the world. They're going to have to end this war and immediately turn to other hot spots in the world before they develop into wars. And so there's a lot at stake, and I believe the public is going to be very serious about it. And my job between now and the time they vote is to reintroduce myself to them in a way that they know more about me. As my pollster said, most people who do know me think I was born behind a podium as Secretary of State, having gone to Yale with a lot of money. That's as far away from listing me as those
poorest
guy. Yeah, but that I understand why people think that. They only see me on Sunday morning shows talking to the talking heads.
Well, you call the Senate a millionaires club. You may not be one of them, but you're in it. Let's go to Oxford,
I'm in
Iowa.
It. You got it. I wish I were a millionaire.
Judy is on the line from Oxford, Iowa. Hi, Judy. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you. I'd like to say that one of the senator's problems is that he is not a straight shooter. I remember those 2002 fake hearings that he held about not whether we should go to war, but some of the little problems that there might be if we did. And I remember the hearings on Gonzales, the confirmation hearings, when he gave him a big hug and said, "I love you, fella." Is that good judgment?
Well, hang on a second. Let's get the record straight. I'm one of the few guys that voted against Gonzales. Let's get the record straight. I voted against Gonzales from the very beginning. And I was being facetious, saying, "I love you, fella, but you're not qualified to be the Attorney General of the United States of America." I was the first person to call for his resignation after being one of the few to vote against him. And in those hearings, go on my website, joebiden.com. I held those hearings ahead of time, and I predicted that if we did go to war, it would cost us billions of dollars, take hundreds of thousands of our troops. We would not be greeted with open arms.
Didn't change your vote.
No, it didn't, because the vote wasn't about going to war in the context. The context of that was, do you give the president the authority to muscle the United Nations into forcing the UN inspectors back in?
John Kerry tried to make that case. It didn't fly.
John Kerry did make that. No, wrong. Let's get the facts straight, Tom.
In his campaign,
he did not make that case. What he made the case was about being for and against the war. That was the part that was uncertain about John. John didn't make the case at that time, nor did anyone else make the case that I recall at that time, that we thought the big mistake we made, a gigantic mistake the vast majority of the Congress made, was thinking that this president was going to conduct the effort as it related to Iraq like he did with Afghanistan. Remember what you were doing on your program and others at that time? The president was giving great kudos for the way he handled Afghanistan. The issue was, has he become an internationalist? Was he, in fact, a guy who had changed his view since he got elected? That was the context. And the context was the Secretary of State and the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff were saying, we don't want to go to war. We're going to get the UN to support getting inspectors back in. It was a mistake. Mistake, but not because we thought we were giving him the power at that time to go in and go to war. And if we did, why did it take so long for it to happen?
Judy in Oxford, Iowa, thank you for your call. Iowa's going to be looming very large. It's looming large already. South Carolina saying it's moving its primary up to January 19th, and talk now, we've just got a minute, Senator Biden, but talk that there may be a cascade of primaries flowing forward, even potentially before Christmas. What do you make of that? How's it shape the campaign, change things?
Well, it's kind of above my pay grade. I haven't figured that out. I've thought a lot more about what I do as president, how to get there. I'm trying to change that, but it seems to me that at all costs, there's a need to preserve the special place of Iowa, New Hampshire, because otherwise it becomes wholesale politics. It gets down to money and nothing else. Those two states, along with South Carolina and Nevada, the only place you can go and actually have your ideas compete. Not one person in any of those states has asked me how much money I've had. They've asked me what I think. But I tell you what, if they lose their primacy, then this is a whole different. A whole different political system.
And we've got 10 seconds. Some say you're really out to be Secretary of State. Is it the White House that you're dead set on?
Absolutely. If I wanted to be Secretary of State, do you think it may be a good idea to take on the people who might become president and point out how wrong they are? I don't think that's the way to do it.
It could be tricky. Senator Joseph Biden of Delaware.
Thanks a lot, Tom.
Democrat, thank you very much for being with us. The new memoir is Promises to Keep on Life and Politics. Senator Joe Biden, thanks for being here. Listeners, thanks to you as well. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.